This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Ways. All right, everybody, get ready to meet New York City's highest earning official. He's a debt collector. It's a great read. It's a great story. And it's a stark reality. Zeke Fox is finance reporter at Bloomberg News, joining Jason and me in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. And this is part of a series. So for those folks who've been checking out your and Zach Mitre's writings in Bloomberg Business Week and on the terminal, this is an ongoing story that you've been writing about.
Yes, so we've been investigating the merchant cash advance industry, and these are companies that lend money to small businesses like a pizzeria or a contractor at interest rates that are crazy high, like 400%, more than loan sharks for the mafia used to charge. And
do most small businesses use these kind of loans to kind of get by?
Not that many use them, but if you own a business, you probably heard from them. They're sending faxes, they're calling you, they're offering you money, they say they can get it quick, it's going to be great. But what we found is that once you take the loan, you're having to make daily payments, you know, often hundreds or thousands of dollars a day. And if you fall behind, they can call in this guy who is has the obscure title of New York City Marshal. He can have your bank account seized and turn over the money in your bank account to the cash advance company before you even know what happened.
So I think if you come to this story cold, not having read the previous story that you guys did, which was the cover in the U.S. For Bloomberg Business Week last week, certainly worth reading because it takes you through the mechanics of this story. At first blush, you see a city official making $1.7 million, by far the highest paid city official, and you go, as Carol Masser might say,
Wait, what?
Wait, what? How does this work? Tell us about this position even and how it came to be.
It's this old-fashioned system that dates back to the Dutch colonial days. They're called New York City Marshals. They're essentially like a sheriff. And if you win a lawsuit against someone and you need to collect money that's owed to you, you can hire one of these marshals who are city officials who have a badge, often carry guns, and they will collect the money for you in exchange for a fee. And so what we found is that one of these guys, Vadim Babarovich, has become the go-to debt collector for these cash advance companies, these predatory business lenders. They're turning to him whenever businesses fall behind. And these fees that he's collecting added up to $1.7 million for him last year, more than anyone else in the city made.
And that's a percentage, obviously, of what he's collected, correct?
Right. He gets to keep 5%. So he's collected quite a lot from small businesses all across the country, which is what we investigated. Technically, the marshals are only supposed to have authority in the city. But there's this loophole, which is that if you have a bank account, let's say you're a guy in Texas, you open a bank account at your local branch. That bank, if they have an office in New York, which many banks do, the marshals can technically go after the money in your bank account as if it was in New York. So these guys are seizing money from small businesses in every state.
Well, and again, taking your previous work and this as a whole, New York plays a central role in this business because you and Zach documented in your previous story that the state, that there are courts upstate from where we are in New York City that are a key part of this machinery that's collecting these debts from people.
So here's how it works. When you apply for the loan, you have to sign this weird document called a confession of judgment, in which you're basically admitting in advance that you didn't pay back the loan. Now, if the lender decides that they are unhappy with you, maybe because you missed some payments or maybe for no reason at all, they can go to court. They pick the court. So usually they go to a small town where that's not that busy, and they file this confession that you already signed. A clerk, not even a judge, will just rubber stamp it without your knowledge, no hearing, no proof required, and that's made your debt official. Then they take this judgment that they've obtained in court to the New York City Marshal, who then delivers it to the bank, which has your accounts frozen and then turns over the money. And this whole process, even though it's pretty convoluted, can all happen within a day or two.
Zeke, to be fair, I mean, none of this is illegal, correct? But there are some questions about the pressure or the tactics maybe to go after some of the money?
That's a good point. I mean, New York is one of the states that allows these confessions of judgment. And the New York City Department of Investigation, which oversees the marshals, said that it is allowed for the marshals to do this. And what the marshals say is that we enforce legal judgments. It's not our job to know what exactly the judgment is based on. We get the paper, we send it to the bank, that's our job.
What does the city get out of it?
So the city is part of this old-fashioned system. Everything the marshal collects, they get a small percentage. It really doesn't add up to much for the city, but that's just the ancient way this was set up.
And was the response that you got from the city essentially like, well, this is how we roll. This yeah. is what we've been doing for hundreds of years.
So the Department of Investigation said that they were looking into these things and that they had been for some time. We don't really know the details of that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, we're not sure exactly what the city makes of this. It could be that not many people knew exactly what was going on.
Yeah. Well, it's a tour de force of reporting, to say the least. We know that there's more to come, and I think I speak for both of us and many out there in saying we can't wait for the next chapter. It's really, really important work that you're doing. Thank you.
Especially when you think about the small businesses and the importance that is to our economy, to see them kind of being squeezed in this way. Maybe legal, but still doesn't feel totally right.
Zeke Fox is a finance reporter. His story, along with Zach Mitre, is on the Bloomberg Terminal and Bloomberg.com right now, part of an ongoing series looking into what is certainly a dark underbelly of the national financial system.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will go.
We are trying to figure out where the financial markets go from here. No doubt about it. Jason mentioned this earlier. We are definitely seeing increased volatility, but maybe not as extreme as some might have thought. But let's get into volatility, what it means for the markets and strategy. Bill Zox is Chief Investment Officer of Fixed Income at Diamond Hill Capital Management, based in Columbus, Ohio, in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio on this Tuesday. First of all, this kind of volatility, it's interesting. You know, we kicked off the year saying, hey, folks, don't freak out. This is more historically normal, the types of swings that we're seeing in the market. What we've seen over the past years has been really complacent, lack of volatility, abnormal lack of volatility in the markets. How do you so talk to me about that, address that in terms of how investors should see the swings that we're seeing currently?
Well, I think this is more normal, but it's been 10 years that central banks around the globe have been suppressing that volatility. So
we kind of forgot.
I think a number of investors have forgotten.
And so what do you do? I mean, you're a fixed income guy, and I think it's safe to say fixed income feels like it's been, left out of the party a little bit as we've been in this, longest ever bull market. People love equities. So give us the case for fixed income in a more volatile world.
Well, I focus on high yield day to day, high yield corporate bonds in the U.S. Yeah. And in an environment like this, you're looking for opportunities. The yield is up 150 basis points year to date to 7.3%. So this is a decent environment.
Right. You can make some money on this market. Well, are you concerned, though? I think we see increasingly the concerns about companies that have taken on too much debt at this point, especially when you have a lot of folks coming on and talking about maybe there's a recession in 2020, economic downturn, earnings still growing but slowing down. So do we need to be worried more about kind of the balance sheets and the amount of debt that folks have taken on?
Yeah, we're definitely later cycle, but late cycle does not mean end of the cycle. So I think you look
for
opportunities.
That's a key point, right? Late cycle doesn't mean the end. How long can the cycle go on?
Look, it could go on for a number of years. That recession could come in 2023. Who knows when that recession? It's very difficult to forecast that. But you look for opportunities. And when you're late cycle, you stay away from the most aggressive financings. I think that's the most important point. But you don't pull back completely.
So what are you staying away from? What are you buying into?
Well, we think the most aggressive financings are LBO private equity sponsored LBO financings. Most of that is done in the loan market. I focus day to day on the high yield bond market, but you see some high yield bonds as part of those LBOs. And I think that's one part of the market you have to stay away from right now.
And what do you make of the Fed's conundrum, shall we say, at this point, where it looked pretty clear that they were on a nice smooth path to raising rates, but now with some of the, not just the market volatility, but certainly some of the underlying data, you're starting to, at least from observers' perspective, see some cracks in the narrative. What do you see going into 19 in terms of what the Fed may or may not do?
Yeah, I don't think that the Fed is going to change its course of action because we're down 10% in equities.
Yeah.
I think the Fed needs to see something much more than that, maybe more like down 20% in equities, much wider credit spreads. I think they're going to stay on course right now.
You know, it's interesting. There's a story on the terminal. The handful of investment grade companies that the market thinks might get cut to high yield have liabilities the size of the entire dollar emerging market corporate bond market, for a little bit of perspectives. I mean, we are at an interesting point, aren't we?
Absolutely. I mean, that is a risk factor. I happen to think that that risk will play out over a number of years. It's not, markets always want to pull everything forward. They want to discount the end of the cycle. They want to discount a huge percentage of those triple Bs in the high yield market. But I think this is a matter of 10, 15 years.
So, Bill, how do you advise folks, investors who are looking kind of at the high yield market at this point in terms of areas? Because you're saying that there's still opportunities and we could stay at this point in the cycle for some time. Give me some, you know, as specific as you can. I mean, would you buy GE debt at this point?
Well, we do not. We are not buying GE debt. It might be in the high yield market at some point. It's fairly difficult to analyze that situation. We'd much prefer bonds issued by small and mid cap issuers. It's easier to get your arms around those.
Great stuff. Bill Zox, Chief Investment Officer of Fixed Income at Diamond Hill Capital Management, usually based over in Columbus, Ohio, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Thank you so much for joining us. So it is an interesting discussion, and I think back to the conversation we started the show with around volatility and around this up and down market mm-hmm. that Dave Wilson was describing. And, you know, you mentioned GM, and that does seem to be a driver here, you know, just recapping some of the headlines that have just come out even since we've been on the air here. You know, the president talking about pulling those subsidies, mm-hmm. whatever they may be, and you know that is hampering GM stock price at least, and making people think about this maybe in a different way.
Well, and speaking of auto, I mean Ford, they have a bunch of short-term liabilities, billions of dollars, just like General Electric for that matter. And so we'll be watching those issues very closely. I also think what he said about in terms of the duration of the cycle.
Yeah.
These cycles can last for a long time.
Hey, oh, where to go, Ohio?
To roll into this conversation. And we have a couple Ohioans and some Columbus guys, to be more specific, some important guys in Columbus. Mayor Andrew Ginther is here with us, and Kenny McDonald, who is the President and Chief Economic Officer of Columbus 2020. Gentlemen, thank you for stopping by to see Carol and myself in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So beyond college football, which obviously Saturday was...
They've been talking about it since they walked in. I'm just going to say...
I started it because it was very exciting. And I have
great
a lot
day
of,
in Columbus.
I have a lot of friends who went to Michigan, and we're just not talking about that right now. But, you know, Mayor Ginther, what's happening beyond college football? Obviously, you know, you're right in the heart of the Midwest there, mm-hmm. Ohio, in the headlines right now, you know, probably not for great economic reasons with GM and whatnot, but take us inside. What's happening?
Well, I think, you know, Columbus is really driving some great economic development and job creation efforts in the Midwest. You know, you take a look at what we've been able to accomplish as a region over the last decade, 150,000 net new jobs, nearly $10 billion in private capital investment, and raising per capita income by 30%. We feel really good about where Columbus is positioned. We know other parts of the state and the Midwest are struggling, but in Columbus, based on our great partnerships, the Columbus way, we believe we do public-private partnerships better in Columbus than anywhere else. And the Harvard Business School agrees. They've written a case study on the Columbus way and the way that we go about economic development, downtown revitalization, but also neighborhood development and reducing infant mortality and expanding high-quality early learning opportunities. using those relationships and that culture of cooperation and collaboration, Columbus is poised for another great decade ahead.
Mm-hmm. I think if Matt Miller was here, of course, at Bloomberg Radio and TV, because he loves Columbus and he's
absolutely
from Columbus.
He does.
But I want to bring in, we're going to be having the Year Ahead event here at Bloomberg in connection with Bloomberg Business Week magazine. I'm going to be talking with the Flint mayor, who obviously have had a crisis to deal with, but they're also trying to revitalize that city. And I'm always curious, what are really the programs that make a difference? Is it infrastructure? Is it tax incentives? Is it creating a tech hub? What is it that really impacts the broader economy of a state?
All of the above. And certainly that's been our approach in Columbus, whether you take a look at, you know, winning the Smart City Challenge and having Smart Columbus really drive our innovation and opportunities for entrepreneurships and startups. You see our first $2 billion babies, homegrown companies, Cover My Meds and Root Insurance.
Yeah.
We have really put forth a great example of the opportunities for entrepreneurs and startups in Columbus, and we're excited about that, in addition to a very strong, healthy corporate community in Columbus, the home of Nationwide and Huntington and American Electric Power, Limited Brands, you know, a great corporate community that's working with us to really unleash the opportunities for job growth and economic development in the future.
So, Kenny, come on in here, because, you know, one of the probably biggest conversations around economic development over the last year or so has been Amazon HQ2. Obviously, it's coming here to New York City and Washington, D.C. You guys were a finalist, though. I have to ask, like, what do you take away from that process that maybe you say, well, we, you know, carved out this idea or we explored this potential program, we're going to put it to work anyway, or we're going to use it to lure another type of company?
I can't believe it took you 90 seconds to ask that question. it was...
we like to ease in.
It reinforced everything that we've been working on for 7 years leading up to that process. And obviously, we've been working with the company very regularly. It's the center of their government cloud operations with three separate sites in the Columbus market and a lot of fulfillment
centers.
Amazon,
that is. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, we're a terrific corporate customer and an existing industry for us in some ways, right? But the process actually highlighted what we had been preparing for and what we probably couldn't have done 10 years earlier, which is we knew who we were. We knew how we wanted to approach it. The platforms were built for a public-private partnership. And quite frankly, our academic partners like Ohio State and other independent colleges around the area to weigh in, be a very full partner in what we proposed and what we're proposing to other people, as a matter of fact.
I always wonder, too, what's the balance here? Because we do a ton of stories. Jason and I talk to a lot of individuals. We do a lot of stories in the magazine about, you know, you want to incent companies to come in. You want to incent industries to come in. You don't want to give away so much that really the economy and the local economy and the community don't benefit.
And let's be honest, that's been one of the criticisms of what Virginia and New York City did in order to win HQ2.
And I think, you know, as you think about it and contemplate, you know, what demographic shifts, the number of boomers that are going to be retiring over the next 10 or 20 years, I think incentives are going to remain a part of it, but talent is really going to drive economic development decisions in the future. And that's why we're really focused on affordability, mobility, and talent. Because in order for us to continue on this trajectory and win the next HQ2 competition, it's going to mean aggressive, strategic, robust, you know, attraction and retention of talent. We're a very young city for the Midwest, one of the youngest cities, fastest growing economy in the Midwest, but we cannot rest on our laurels and hope for the best. We have to remain aggressive and thoughtful, you know, putting together competitive incentive packages that are thoughtful and that balance community concerns and needs, but also making sure that we have the talent to support those companies of the future.
What do you have to do, though, to make sure you have the talent that's going to be needed by an HQ10 or whatever it may be?
It used to be that you built a great economy and people came to you, and that's still true. Columbus has had a great growth rate because we have a great city and a great place, but we also have a great economy. People are coming there for exciting career opportunities and, you know, kind of world-class work, whether that's gene therapy or data analytics. They're moving to the market from, you know, 12 of the top 50 engineering schools are within 200 miles. Lots of those computer science grads, data analytics grads are gravitating towards us. But it's also not enough anymore. Yeah. You also have to have a community that knows its values. That's part of what the Columbus Way is all about. You have to have you have to be building the right place. You have to have policies that attract young workers and young families.
Meaning what?
Meaning that you have to lean into the future, and it's changing every day, and you have to be able to clearly state who you are, and you quite frankly have to be open to not only the people, but the ideas they bring that may change some of the things that you have historically done
diversity,
as a place.
In other words.
Yeah, embracing diversity, being smart and open. That's how we brand ourselves as a community. There are an awful lot of people that have moved to Columbus from around Ohio and the Midwest. That's not enough. Based on the trajectory where we're at, and if we want to continue to punch above our weight as a city, we have to attract the best and brightest from around the country and the world. And that's what is going to be required for that talent.
All right, Mayor Ginther, 20 seconds left. As Ohio goes, so goes the country. It's one of the most politically important states in the nation. What's the political mood of Ohio right now? What's the political mood of Columbus? 20 seconds.
You know, it remains a place where an awful lot of Ohio has not seen what Columbus has experienced. There's a big difference. We talk about the Columbus bubble.
Yeah.
There's a big difference between Columbus and Central Ohio and the rest of the state.
Pretty paper. Pretty ribbons of blue.
People are ready.
Is that Willie Nelson?
Wrap your present.
No, is it Willie?
To your darling.
Boom.
From
God,
you.
The whole world just comes together.
It really does.
I'm just going to say. Willie Nelson, love some pretty Willie on this Tuesday. He's going to lead us to talking a little bit about retail, which is, I feel like, tis the season because we are definitely all things retail. Jen Redding in the house, senior retail analyst over at Wedbush Securities, based in Los Angeles.
Nope, based in New York.
Based in New York. Paul Brennan just said that, so forgive me. This is what happens.
She's a New Yorker.
I write my teases early.
She's tough. She's a tough New Yorker. She's not some soft Angelino. Come on.
Maybe she's a little mixture of both. She's in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio, as I said, on this Tuesday. So retail, they had a great start this holiday shopping season.
Yeah, they kicked it off strong, better than anyone expected, especially online. Store traffic was a little bit softer.
Okay. So wait, dig a little bit deeper into that. Kind of, as I say, unpack that. I hate that expression.
Yeah.
Unpack it anyway. So dig a little bit deeper into what we saw online and what we saw in brick and mortar.
Sure. So online, we saw e-commerce sales surge about 25-30%.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Much better than people were thinking, about 15-18. So it was a lot higher than analysts expected. And then in stores, people were thinking flattish to up low single digit foot traffic. And it actually was down low single digits. Depending on what estimates you look at, down low single digits to a decline of down mid to high single digits. So it was a disappointment in foot traffic on stores.
And some of the winners, it feels like, that have emerged in your research and others are not maybe the obvious ones. Children's Place, Lululemon is a name that we talk about a lot on this show, and Kohl's. So pick one, and like, what was the secret to their success?
Because they're not the same.
Yeah.
Right?
Nope. I would say the thing that the three of them have in common, they all three have pretty good omnichannel platforms.
Yeah.
So they have good websites that you can go on. Their websites are fast. Their emails are mobile friendly. And they really cater to the online consumer. So everybody after Turkey, they wanted to get online and shop. They didn't want to go out at midnight shopping. And all three of those websites cater to the online shopper. And I think Lulu had a great holiday. What makes Lulu different, in addition to all the investments they've made to their online platform and makes it easy to shop, is that they messaged Black Friday on their website this year. So they normally have a sales section that says, "We made too much." They don't market it Black Friday online. This year they changed that messaging, and they changed "We made too much" of their sales section of Black Friday. And I think it just drove people crazy that they were finally promoting the Black Friday and took the website down.
Do consumers respond to that? I mean, I think I did as a consumer that I would look, oh, what's the Black Friday deals kind of thing?
Yeah, I think consumers do respond to it. And I think even analysts and Wall Street people get hyped up about all the discounting that's going on out there. When you look at...
Is there a ton of discounting going on?
It's funny because the messaging for discounting is high. And you think, oh, it's 50% off. But when you actually scrape the data on the websites, it's actually 3% higher on average for retail. So you're not, it's not discounting really that, you know, the out the door price that we pay is 3% higher.
Wow.
On average.
So what about Children's Place? Because that's a name that we don't hear a lot about and certainly don't hear a lot of positive news about it. What you mentioned the website, but is there something more to take away from how they did?
Yeah, so they kept their promotions pretty similar to last year, which is a positive for margins. And then I think free shipping that they offer, similar, you know, Amazon does that, but a lot of specialty retailers don't do it.
Right.
And I think they're getting share from Gymboree and, you know, some share from Carter's and some from department stores. So that's helping them. And I like them for holiday. But you know what? When a recession comes, because it will come, I like them for that because they've been one of the best management teams that I think will lead them through all times.
It is kind of interesting, and I find myself doing this with my daughter. Like, you know, if she's looking at something, like, well, is it free shipping? What's the return policy? No, I want to know the ease of, is there going to be a hassle if we order something? And it will sway us to sometimes go somewhere else. At the same time, I do feel like when there's strong brand identities, like a Lululemon, where people will say, no, I don't want just a pair of leggings. I want Lululemon leggings.
Yeah.
Like, you tend to then say, okay, you know, I'll go with whatever they want to do, you know, and you'll buy up for that.
Yep, I agree with that. And even when you look at Lulu, they offer free shipping and free returns anyways, right? So right. I think the strong brand identities mostly will do the free shipping, free returns.
So we look at this against the backdrop of, you know, some not so great retail news, whether it's Sears or Penny's especially. What's the other side of this? Who were the losers as you went through Black Friday and beyond?
Sure. So I think that we saw, you know, Urban Outfitters was interesting to me because usually a retailer doesn't switch their promotions in the middle of a holiday. And on Cyber Monday, they switched their promotions and became incrementally more promotional, which is usually just a, you know, something you want to pay attention to.
Which ticks us off as shoppers if I bought on Black Friday.
exactly. So Free People was 30% off sale Cyber Monday. That's the email they sent out. Later in the evening, it went to 50% off.
Wow.
So, yep, something that makes shoppers mad.
So interesting. Jen Redding, senior retail analyst over at Wedbush, based in New York City, here with us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio.
One quick question, 10 seconds. If it starts off strong, does it continue strong throughout the season or not necessarily?
I mean, we'll have ups and downs, but yeah, I think we're going to have a bang of a holiday season.
There you go. Did you start shopping?
You know, just a tiny, tiny bit. I should have done more, and I just didn't.
You will.
I don't know. I wasn't feeling
well
over the
November.
Weekend.
You were sick.
I know. So I need to get back into it. And I do feel like a lot of places are extending into Cyber Monday.
So
and so we'll see. Maybe I'll still get some deals. Yeah.
Inventory is good, too. Good to know. This is Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close. Happy to have back with us Abe Deshpande, founder and chief investment officer at Centerstone Investors, back in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're having a fun chat on a lot of different things before we get going here. Let's talk, though. I don't know. What's on your mind here right now when you're looking at the markets?
Well, you know, Centerstone we're value investors, we're bottom-up investors.
So you're happy,
we're global.
Right?
You know, we're also, we just look at the fundamentals of businesses typically and don't spend so much time on like the noise of the macro, the headlines. Every now and then, you know, I do start to get concerned about certain things. And although the fundamentals of the businesses we track are pretty good, we're still, and with the volatility, we're able to find a few things here and there.
Just a few things despite the market pullback that we have seen?
It's a pretty modest pullback, but I mean, we've put a few percentage points of cash to work. Some of the areas that have been hit the hardest are areas that we don't particularly care for, you know, REITs and utilities and things that have a lot of debt on them, you know, all kinds of different things have fallen that we just say pass because it doesn't fit our model.
Right.
That's us from a fundamental perspective. Now, I have to, like, this is probably going to sound like a mixed message because as a fundamental long-term investor, all I'm really concerned about is the business pacing forward, you know, over the next 5 or 10 years. I don't judge our returns based on a year or 6 months. But, you know, most investors do get very, pushed around by stock market volatility. And here, I mean, there's just so many things that can go wrong from a short-term perspective all at the same time. And I can't remember the last time I've seen that. You know, you've got the Federal Reserve is setting the path of the stock market with its interest rate moves up. Mm-hmm. You've got, of course, you know, tweet of the day can introduce volatility. And then internationally, because, you know, we focus globally, but we have a primary emphasis on non-U.S. markets. Brexit is becoming an increasing concern for me. I kind of used to put it in that bucket of cooler heads will prevail. And now, you know, odds are increasing that, that might not be the case.
And so play that out for us, because I think that's a big question that at least I have, which is, from an investor's perspective, what does that look like? Where does it hit your portfolio if we end up in this kind of essentially messy no deal divorce situation?
And that is the worst case scenario. Yeah. So that's not necessarily what I'm expecting, but we do need to scenario plan.
But
at this
point, let's be honest, that feels more likely, or more possible, I should say, than it did even 6 months ago. Everyone's like, absolutely, they'll get to a deal, yes. But like.
Yeah, so the primary, I think, two or three paths for that. One is that Theresa May gets booted out, and there's a new guy that comes in. His name's Jeremy Corbyn, and his economic policies are, I don't think, have been really discounted by the stock markets. But I think the more immediate impact is what happens to the supply chains and everything if there is no, you know, agreement on the borders, and then you have that possibility of contagion leaching into the European banks, which themselves aren't that strong, at a moment where the European economy is starting to weaken. And here then, does that then become another 2011 where they come out and they need Federal Reserve, lines of credit and whatnot to backstop their own banking system? But, you know, the world is structurally short dollars. So whenever there's a risk event like this, there's a rush into the dollar. And that's why you see like these perverse things happen. The dollar goes up instead of down during crisis.
Because it's a safe haven.
If it's a safe haven and the world is structurally short of dollars, their funding needs require more dollars, and especially when there's a liquidity crisis. Does that then take liquidity out of the U.S. markets? And so that contagion effect, I see there's a path for that to happen. Again, it's not even a 50% chance, but that's just one thing that could go wrong. Well, there's so many others.
Did you say, you know, you look at your individual investment stories and you're looking at them specifically and then somehow maybe look at some of the macro stuff that's going on. But, you know, I was reading in this morning and the idea that I feel like we're hearing more folks talk about a recession in the United States. And of course, when the U.S. sneezes, right, everybody feels it. We know that. So are you thinking about that scenario? And already you've got concerns overseas and how that might play in.
Yeah, I think for at least the time of frame that we are able to see, which is what our companies are telling us, so 3 to 6 months, there's like a zero chance of that here.
Yeah.
But, you know, these other external factors can tip things into, you know, another direction. And that's why, you know, I keep on going back to this. There's so many things that can go wrong. People are trying to figure out what other reasons they can assign for the stock market volatility. From our point of view, the primary driving force for the trend down in equity prices is just the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates. We talked about this in the beginning of the year, actually. I think the stock market was near its peak, and we talked about how, short rates are already competitive with dividend yields on stocks.
Right.
Next year, the analysts who follow S&P 500 are projecting earnings growth of around 4%. Well, you know, if you have short-term cash yielding 3 or 4%, that's an intrinsic value.
Why would you take on the additional risk of equities?
Yes. So there's that convergence, as I said, of lots of things at the same time that's kind of bothering me a little bit.
And that's a bigger story that we keep talking about in the magazine, right? We keep referencing, was it Peter Coy who did the story of just comparing, you know, what you're seeing in fixed income yield versus equity yield, right? As they get more compatible. Why would you take on that additional risk?
Yeah. So actually what we're looking at now, we're starting to look at, corporate bonds.
Wow.
Higher grade corporate bonds that are now yielding
highly rated.
Highly rated or high grade. Yeah.
Yeah.
Corporate bonds that are starting to yield 4, 5, 6%.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern only on Bloomberg Radio.